Welcome to the Human Performance Podcast. Here we talk about everything to do with human performance and how leaders and organizations can get the best out of themselves and their people. I'm your host, Alex Young. My guest on the podcast this week is David Richards. David is an international best-selling author, life strategist, and yoga instructor. He spent his early childhood years living in various parts of the United States and 3 years living on the island of Okinawa, Japan. After graduating with a bachelor's degree in English, he was commissioned as an officer in the Marines. He earned 2 master's degrees while on active duty and was part of the initial landing force in Somalia in support of Operation Restore Hope. David and I discuss visualizing success, the power of meditation, and shaping our thoughts. Hey, David, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Alex. How are you?
I'm really, really good. Really good. It's fantastic to connect, albeit obviously virtually at the moment. We are very excited to kind of dive into your story today. Just looking through kind of online, reading your background, it's absolutely fascinating. But rather than me kind of talk through it and butcher it, it'd be great for you just sort of tell everyone a little bit about yourself.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you so much first for having me on. But I grew up in the military. My name is David Richards. So my dad was a Marine. So I was born just outside Washington, D.C. in 1969, moved around, and that was life. The idea of staying in one place was a foreign concept because we moved every 2 or 3 years. When I was 10, we moved to Japan. So I spent 3 years in Okinawa, Japan. So put that in context, this is 4 or 5 years after the Vietnam War. There's a heavy military presence in Okinawa. But at the same time, as a 10-year-old kid, it's a paradise because it's completely un-American. You're just like, this is amazing. So came back to the States, fell in love with writing. I really enjoyed writing in high school, and it was something that I wanted to do more of, but didn't have the confidence to do it. Didn't have any imagination in terms of what I could do outside the military because that's all I knew. So it came time to make a choice how I was going to pay for university. And I remember my parents sat me down. They said, we'll pay for half. You got to pay for the other half. You can get a job. If you can't get if you choose not to get a job, you get a scholarship. That's great. So I went the path of, okay, I'm going to join the military, but I'm not going to join the Marines because I didn't like the Marines because of my dad, and moving. And so I was going to join the Navy. I went to Penn State University here in Pennsylvania. Found the Navy was too hard because it was too mechanical. And my brain didn't quite think that way. So I'm like, I'm going to join the Marines. So I joined the Marines, graduated, went to Somalia as part of the initial landing force in Operation Restore Hope. And then as my career progressed, I felt like there was kind of a split because I started to realize that I didn't like the lifestyle of the military, which is what I resented growing up. And yet now I had chosen that as my career path. So I started to become disenchanted. And then in 2005, 2006, I had a surgery to remove a benign tumor from my neck. And I really kind of, that was pause, gave me pause. And I'm like, you know what? That's not what I'm going to do. So I realized later, I didn't realize at the time, but I was leaving the military for the first time in my life. So I got out in 2006, went to work for an IT company, but immediately just happened upon yoga. After 2 classes of yoga, I was hooked. I became a yoga instructor a year later. I've been teaching yoga now for 14 years. But just kept on that journey. And then 2017, wrote my first book, Whiskey and Yoga, about finding your purpose in life. And then last year, my second book, The Lighthousekeeper, came out.
Absolutely amazing. I mean, such an incredible, personal journey as well as, kind of work journey as well. One thing I just wanted to dive into, I ran the Tokyo Marathon back in 2014. I was only in Japan for literally a matter of weeks, but it was such an amazing culture, such an amazing city. I mean, how do you think that kind of affected, being over there, early in your, childhood and sort of seeing all the different kind of cultural differences?
Well, in so many ways, it's a great question because I think in so many ways it was, you can say, as a kid, you can say your formative years are from when you're a kid till you're, 20 or something. But I think you really start to come online as a person. You really start to become self-aware when you become a teenager. So building up to that as a 10, 11, 12, and 13-year-old in Japan was hugely impressionable. I mean, just to be exposed to Eastern philosophy, to hear their ceremonies when they had like ceremonies to honor the dead, or to see these massive kind of tombs that you could go like in the woods, you could just come across this tomb and it had these little teacups next to it where they were honoring someone. It might have incense next to it. And you just like, there's this awe, like, what is this? And it'd be statues of Buddha. And so, and then, you know, so that was sort of the mystical part of Okinawa. But the practical part as a kid was, their toys are awesome. Like, these toys are so much better than the crap we have in America. This is amazing. Their art is incredible. Like, their art was just like, the lines were so different how they drew stuff. They had video games. Like, I remember Space Invaders. I played Space Invaders on a tabletop video game in this little like game place in Okinawa. So it was really amazing. At the same time, there was the culture, but there was also the poverty. Like, you saw real poverty, like people, like villages that were nothing more than corrugated aluminum, you know, panels. And that was like, so when storms came and typhoons came, you'd watch these things get destroyed and the people just have to rebuild. And so then pivot in 1982 to come back to the United States, where no one, you know, maybe a fraction of a percent of the US population was in the military and had kids who just happened to go to Japan. But otherwise, nobody in my school really had that experience. And so everybody's kind of focused on a different thing. What it really showed me was I started meditating, at least flirting with the idea of meditation, probably when I was 13 or 14, because that was something that I had taken away, was just, there was a beauty in Japanese culture that I couldn't quite identify. And I think what I've come to look at it as now is the Japanese practice the culture of like kind of beauty in motion. Like, if you've heard of the tea ceremony, the ceremony itself is so beautiful because everything is done with intention and with purpose. And that's kind of like yoga. You move with purpose and intention. But the idea of being still is almost a way of saying that's when you're truly present. And so that's what drew me to meditation. So I would be meditating on a Friday night for 20 minutes in my living room, my parents' living room, with like a Japanese sword that I had taken back with me in front of me. All my friends would be out at football games or drinking or partying, and I'm doing this. So yeah, it was hugely impressionable. And I think that was probably the biggest conduit or factor for me to get into yoga when I got out of the Marines, because it was that Eastern part of me and like, okay, I could do this.
It's really, really interesting because, I guess, you know, fast forward to kind of now, if you look at school systems, basically across the world, there's such a huge push for well-being for yep. students around kind of exams and things like that. And now things like meditation and mindfulness and growth mindset and, you know, the childlike mind and sort of a lot of sort of Zen type philosophy is being sort of brought into school systems. Is that, have you found that kind of interesting, having that kind of, you know, particular upbringing, which you were already, you know, doing a lot of that yourself?
I think it's fascinating because I think in high school or at school in general, it's all about, I hate to say it, but it's all kind of about the party line. Like, this is the standard and you have to meet that or exceed that standard. And that's what our testing is about and everything else. And you see that reflected in corporate, you know, in the business world too, to an extent, or at least historically you did. And now that you're catering to, oh my gosh, we're all individuals and we all are our own unique cocktail of mind, body, and spirit. And your mindset could be completely different from my mindset, even if we're observing or experiencing the same thing. And so to tune into that at a young age and to say, okay, you're going to cultivate this as a tool for your own self-development as you get older, I think it's tremendously insightful. I think that is hugely important because, you know, as we, especially in this day and age now where everything's so virtual, but it comes back to, oh my God, we really are individuals. And at the same time, even though you're 4,000, 5,000 miles away, you and I have the same wants and needs in our life. Like, they're basic. Like, we want happiness. We want fulfillment. We want to contribute. We want certainty. We want variety. We want love. We want connection. We want significance. We want growth. We want contribution. And the sooner you can realize that you don't have to, because if you didn't conform to the standard, you know, previously, then that was cause for being ostracized. And now it's not about the standard. It's about how do we maximize your individual potential, which I think is the key for really a successful future.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we'll dive into, you know, life choices and big decisions in a second. But before we kind of get there, I guess, you know, in your journey, the next sort of step for you was obviously going into the Marines. And we've had, you know, lots of military personnel on the podcast, both in the US, from the UK and from further afield as well. And you know, everyone, I think, globally is very grateful for anyone in the military in their service. But you know, part of the Marines especially is that trajectory of hard work, of getting through kind of boot camps and you know, basically being beaten down and then built back up. I mean, in terms of like kind of human performance and both the mental and physical side, could you speak to that?
Yeah, it's so true. And it's interesting because so I was born in the Marines. So I was always going to be a Marine. I just didn't know it. And because it was just, I was raised like in the Roman days, the Roman soldiers left the families at home to go fight. And we do that now, but the families go wherever the military people go. And so I joined the Marines, one, because it was a path I was familiar with, but two, because I was like, if I can do anything, I can be a Marine. Like I've been around this my whole life. And initially I put my application in, it got rejected because my grades weren't great. My physical fitness wasn't great. And like my best friend, my college roommate, he got it. And so I was sort of devastated. I remember I sat in my room listening to Patience by Guns N' Roses. And I was like, this is actually going to take work. Like this is like, it was kind of the first time in my life that I was like, okay, you can't just sort of finesse your way through this, or like, you know, you have to plan and you have to prepare. And if you really want to be a Marine, you're going to have to earn it. It doesn't matter that your dad was in for 31 years or whatever. And so I went down that path. So then I got it. I went to officer candidate school, and it's officer candidate school is designed to see if you can take it. That's all it is. And it's for us, it was 6 weeks. You got up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And you had basically 30 minutes a day that was yours. The other from 4 a.m. until 8 p.m., you were on someone else's time, and you were training, you were eating, you were doing physical exercise, you were studying. Even after you ate, you'd go outside and you'd stand at attention, like rigid, and you'd have this little notebook of all this information you were supposed to remember or understand, and you'd study that until everybody else finished eating. And I remember leading up to that. So at Penn State here, the university I went to, we had a pretty good program. So you went to officer candidate school, excuse me, at the summer of between your junior and senior years of university. And prior to that, in the spring semester, we met Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at I think 5:30 or 6 in the morning. And we would work out for an hour. And then sometimes on weekends, we would go into the woods surrounding the university, and we would do land navigation exercises. So you use a compass and a map to get from one point to the other. So it was all preparation and training. And it just so happened that I turned 21 during the night before we were supposed to have one of these exercises. We were going to go it was a Wednesday. I think I turned 21 Wednesday. So Tuesday night at midnight, 21 at the bars, drunk, missed the morning exercise. And I'll never forget, my roommate came back from the exercise, got back into bed because we didn't have class until later. And I don't know, it's probably about 7:30 or 8:00. There's a pounding on our door. And like go away. And the pounding keeps coming. And it's the Marine instructor who's responsible for the physical fitness. And he doesn't open the, I think he opens the door and he said, why? I want to know why a midshipman missed my training exercise this morning. You'll be at the building at like 10 o'clock to see me. And so I went to see this. He was a gunnery sergeant. I went to see this gunnery sergeant and he sat me down. And this is probably, you know, 3 months before we're going to go to officer candidate school. And he said, I don't know if you can make it. I don't know if you have what it takes. And it was, Alex, it was like another punch in the gut. It was like, what do you mean? Like, I've been in the Marine Corps my entire life. What do you mean I don't have what it takes? And it was just like, it was a slap in the face. So I got really serious and focused. And I think what you find in the Marine Corps, both in training and then when you actually get into real world situations, is you are going to be beaten down. You are going to be built back up. But a lot of that is also an inside job. Like, you beat yourself down, because in this case, there is a standard, and that standard can be the difference between life and death. And you don't want to be the weak link that gets someone else killed or gets someone else injured. And so it fires the engine inside you to say, okay, I'm going to push through this. I'm going to do this. And in training, for example, I remember there was a guy who was really well built, really physically fit, but he didn't have any cardio. He didn't have any ability to really go on distances. And so we would go on hikes and we'd have all our gear on. And I remember it was so hot. It was like July in Virginia here. And it was so hot and muggy, and he was falling behind. And he was starting to whine. And so I just told him, grab the back of my kit and I will take you up this hill. And so we started doing that. And then one of the instructors saw it and he's like, stop. And that guy didn't make it through training. Like, he lasted, I think, another week or so. He didn't make it through training. But again, it's not about like we're best friends. It's about like, I'll carry what I can of you, but you ultimately have to carry your own weight.
Yeah, it's really interesting hearing you speak, because obviously, you know, those kind of two instances, you know, first obviously kind of not getting into the Marines and then kind of overcoming that and getting in, and then obviously when you're pulled aside, those kind of elements of kind of, you know, almost failure and rejection, and then your kind of response to that was, you know, I'm going to get over this, I'm going to prove these guys wrong. Where do you think that kind of came from? Because, you know, I guess a lot of people in that same situation, they might have just, you know, thrown in the towel or given up.
I think a lot of it was pride, really, because like, my best friend who had got accepted when I didn't, we went to high school together. Like, we've known each other at this point for 8 years. And I mean, that was almost half my life. And like, I loved him. And I wanted to have those experiences with him, because like, this is like, I wanted to serve. Like, I wanted to have, like, I hated the fact that we moved so much, because I remember, especially like, it was, again, Japan was so cathartic, because that was where I had my first real tangible best friend. And our families moved. Mine went to North Carolina, his went to Virginia. And I blamed my dad. I was like, oh, like, what would it be like to grow up with a best friend and you went through all sort of the phases of life with, and that didn't happen. And so I think it was, I knew I could do this. Like, I knew there was something fire inside me. It was like, you have only just begun to tap the potential. And I think the big shift for me was that first not getting accepted, because when I didn't get accepted and everyone else did, I completely shifted my game. I stopped partying. Like, I just cut that off. I had nothing on my mind except my grades and my physical fitness. And that was it. So I remember my roommate used to joke with me, because he said, you leave our house and you speed walk to class. It's the weirdest thing, because it's like you're power walking, but you're dressed for school. You've got your backpack with your books and pens and stuff, but you're just like speeding to class. I'm like, yeah, I have to get this done. And so then, because I wasn't drinking, I would go play basketball for 2 or 3 hours. I would go to the gym, or I'd go outside and run. And I turned it around. And once I hit that, like, studying became easier for me. Like, if suddenly studying wasn't this struggle of how do I focus on this material and absorb it so I can relay it. It was something that I could do really easy and not take a lot of time. And so I think once I knew I had that, I said, okay, there's something inside me that I can chisel, that I can polish, that I can refine. And the more I do that, the more I can accomplish.
And you know, kind of moving forward in your kind of Marines journey, what were some of your, you know, best and worst experiences kind of when you were, you know, when you were serving or when you were on kind of active duty, and what kind of then led you to that sort of life-changing point where you're thinking, actually, you know, I need to go and do something else?
I think without question, the best experience was landing in Somalia. And it, it, because it covered such a kaleidoscope of emotions and thoughts in an incredibly short period of time. So I was on, in the Marines, you do what they call deployments. And so you'll go on Navy ships that are designed to carry Marines, and you'll either be in the Pacific or the Atlantic, but you're out there for 6 months and you're basically like a police officer on patrol, except you're on patrol for the world. So if something happens, you're going to go and you'll be the first ones there. You kick the door in, and then, you know, Army forces, Air forces, more Marines come in after you. I was in artillery, so I blew stuff up for a living, which was incredibly satisfying. It wasn't the danger. So my dad had been in the infantry, and it wasn't the danger of being that close to the infantry, although I was with the infantry, but it was also sort of glamorous because artillery, you know, at least I think back to like Napoleon, or like artillery used to change the outcomes of battles. They call it the king of battle. So I graduated from artillery school. I went to my first unit outside of San Diego, California, and they were already preparing to go on a deployment. And so what that means is you get all the money, you're getting all the funding, so you can do all the training. And so like, we're dropping out of these, you know, dropping down on ropes out of helicopters. We are like performing mock raids on the coast of San Diego with these little rubber boats. We're shooting artillery on islands. We're spending days on ship. It's awesome and fun. And then you actually go on the deployment, go to Hawaii. Our steering broke, so we actually went back to Okinawa. So it was the first time, it was 1992. So the first time I'd been back to Okinawa since 1982. So that was kind of cool. And then Singapore. And then from Singapore, we were supposed to go do training in Kuwait for like a month, and then we would go down to Australia, which everyone wanted to go to Australia because like the Australians are cool and they drink beer and it's gonna be fun. and so that was like let's do that. So we left Singapore, and this is, I guess, right around Thanksgiving or just after Thanksgiving in 1992, which here in the US is late November. And we got diverted. They said, there's a famine and there's humanitarian crisis in Somalia. So we're going to send the Marines there, and you're going to go and provide food and security and stabilize the country so that we can deal with this famine. And so it was really like this, oh my gosh, this is intense. So there was all this planning we were doing. And as an artilleryman, artillery doesn't normally, when you do an amphibious landing, the first thing you have to do is establish kind of a foothold. So you have to get on the beach and make sure that you can bring other forces on and stuff like that. And so artillery, the howitzers themselves, the guns themselves, are usually really big, and they usually don't come on shore until 3 or 4 days after you've established that foothold. So I was going to be what they consider a provisional rifle platoon commander. So I was going to take a group of Marines who are like the headquarters of Marines, like the comm guys, the supply guys, and we were going to form this small platoon of infantrymen, and we would be assigned a mission. So we did the planning, and then the intel we had said there are going to be 1,000 armed Somalis at the beach in Mogadishu to meet us in the morning. And so like, okay, there's like 1,500 Marines or so, and there's probably another 800 sailors. And granted, we've got a lot of good weapons, probably much better than they have, but we're also landing when only a few of those Marines can really fight if we're in the water still when they start shooting at us. So you go to bed, and we went to bed like lights out at 8 o'clock. We're gonna get up at midnight, get dressed, get our weapons, everything else. And you can't sleep because you're trying to reconcile what's gonna happen in the morning.
Was this kind of first active combat for you, or do you been in?
It was. No, I was. I mean, this was. I was. So I'd, at this point, I'd been in the Marines for like a year and a half, and all that was training. Desert Storm was over. There was like the ceasefire campaign at Desert Storm because we participated in that. But no, this was it. So like, I'm 23 years old, and I'm going to lead Marines into combat. You're like, okay. And you're just trying to reconcile that bullets don't discriminate. They just go where they're told. And this person who may kill me doesn't know me from Adam, but they're going to shoot me because they think I'm going to harm them in some way. So you're wrestling with these thoughts. Finally, it's time to wake up. You get dressed. You go down into like the dark well of the ship to get all your stuff. And then they have these amphibious tractors that the Marines use to go ashore. And so you get one of those. And long story short, we get into the water. It's about 4:30, 4 o'clock in the morning or so. the moon is setting over Africa. So it's really beautiful. So we started moving ashore, and I'm one of the track commanders. So I was going to have the responsibility to take our 17 Marines, go outside the airfield and set up a roadblock for people trying to get into the airfield. It's just going to confiscate weapons from them. And that sort of feels weird when you're like, okay, there's 1,000 armed Somalis. Well, there weren't 1,000 armed Somalis. At some point where it's still dark, but you start to see flashes from the beach. And in Marine training, you get shot at, you know, close, you get proximity shots fired near you. So you understand what bullets sound like when they pass by you. And you didn't hear anything. So we get closer and it's all media. It's all news crews. Like the beaches, there's no Somalis anywhere, but it's like CNN and ABC and all these camera crews who are filming us coming ashore. And so you think about the range of emotion you went through the night before, now to see like people who won't move to, you know, so you can proceed with your mission filming you. And it was so surreal, but we, you know, we stayed in Somalia 2 months. And that to me was gratifying because it was, we were the first, like I was one of the first Marines ashore, and we, there was a real honest intent to make a difference there with that mission. Like I remember on Christmas Day, we provided escort for a food convoy. And I had a chance to share with Somali kids, like these boys came up to me and were trying to have the conversation because they wanted to take the food from the trucks and just go home and eat. And I had to explain to them, you know, using hand motions, basically, that the food goes into the distribution center and then it goes out through the entire city. And finally, one of the boys caught on and everybody started smiling. And so we took a picture. And so that was like, that was one of my favorite moments. And then I think the worst moment, one of the worst moments of my military career probably was just, I think just getting to a place, I think just really getting to the place that, you know, they say, if you're going to get out, you want to get out like at 8 or 10 years. Because then you haven't invested too much. And so I was at, I think I was at 15 when I had the surgery, but I was also like, I was kind of looking like, I didn't want to be a Marine anymore. Like I've done this my entire life. I just didn't have a uniform for most of it. And I think that was, it wasn't a bad moment in the sense that I was like, oh, why did I wait so long? But I think it was just, it was hard because I knew I was saying goodbye to some incredible people and I was so grateful to serve with them, but I also felt like I didn't want to let them down by getting out. And that was, I think the part that was hard.
And how old were you at this point when you were making the decision to leave?
So in 2006, I was 37.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Cause I took the decision. I was a little bit younger. So I was around 30 when I took the decision to kind of leave healthcare, which, you know, it's really interesting. And it's a whole conversation itself. You know, a lot of like people's identity stems from their jobs and, you know, you probably quite similar to me, a lot of probably, you know, parental, you know, pride with kind of what you were doing for your career and, you know, helping people and things like that. How difficult was it, you know, not just for yourself to kind of come to terms with that decision, but also like tell other people about it?
It was a struggle because, in some ways I felt like I was letting down my dad because my dad had served. It was ironic in that my dad retired while I was becoming an officer. Like he retired, I couldn't attend his retirement ceremony because it happened while I was at officer candidate school going through this rite of passage. I think there was that disappointment. And then I remember I crafted an email to some of my close friends because I'd had the good fortune to get go through two master's programs in the Marine Corps, one of which, you know, let us go to Europe for 3 weeks and study battlefields. And so, and everyone had to study a battlefield. And then you explained why the commander made the decisions they made, because that's what the class, the purpose of the program was. We went to Vietnam for 10 days. And so these are guys I love dearly. And some of them were in Iraq at the time. And I was in like this sort of cushy job in Miami working in Central America as part of our Southern focus. And so I wrote this email. I said, hey, you know what? My game's over. Like I've done this, but I know that I have to go do something else. And within a minute, my phone rang. And it was a very good friend of mine, another Dave, who was actually in Iraq at the time. And he was calling me from Iraq to say like, hey, love you. I know this is a tough decision, but you know, have a support, anything I do for you, don't let me down. And so it was really gratifying, but I think what I didn't appreciate was how sort of terrified I was of stepping into a world that I literally knew nothing about, because the only time we'd lived among civilians was 4 years when I was just starting grade school.
Wow.
So it was early 70s, but everything else was on a military base, surrounded by military families, growing up with military culture.
Well, that's incredible. And so how did that kind of transition then come about, and how did you kind of end up in, you know, the yoga phase, which you obviously are very passionate about now?
Yeah. So I mean, even just the idea of looking for a job was a foreign thing, because the military always kind of told you where you're going to go, or you could say, well, here's what I want to do. And they said, okay, here's what's available to you. But it was always like, it was kind of a guarantee until you decided to retire, until they said, okay, we're done with you. So even looking for a job was weird. I only applied to three places. I applied to an IT company. I applied to one of the people who had gone through one of these master's programs, had gotten out of the Marine Corps, and had started a security firm out of Bahrain in the Middle East. Well, basically they were mercenaries. And so I, because we're alumni, I reached out to him and was looking at, okay, I'll completely leave the world I know behind even further, like in terms of the US, but at least I'll be doing something because I'll have a weapon in my hand. And I know that mindset. And then I applied to a defense contractor just outside Washington, DC, because one of my old bosses worked there. And the mercenary thing had this tremendous sort of romantic appeal, because it was like pirates, sort of like scandalous. I could probably make a lot of money and it'd be sort of exotic and dangerous.
I was going to say, that definitely sounded the coolest when you were
but then you realize, okay, if I practically consider that, I will never probably have a normal life, because I could either get killed, or like I'm going to be so far away from what I'm familiar with that I'm going to become local or native and just become, you know, part of the Middle East in some way. And so I kind of pushed that aside. I interviewed at the IT company. And then by the time I flew up to Washington, DC to meet the defense contractor, I had a job offer from the IT company. And I was so ecstatic, because it was more money than I had seen. Like even when I was negotiating the salary, because the guy who hired me, thank goodness, was himself a Marine. I think because I had done the research on what I made, and he said, he's like, what price are you thinking? What's your salary? And so I gave him a number. And he's like, yeah, you probably want to go a little bit higher than that. So like, what boss, what hiring manager is going to say that to you? So he gave me a number. I'm like, okay, that's good. And so I got out. And I think it was the weekend after actually leaving active duty that I read a sports magazine about American football players using yoga to strengthen their midsections. And so I work out a lot. I lift weights. I'm like, well, that might be interesting. Like, to stretch a little bit, that'd be kind of cool. So I took a class. It was a gentle class. And there's so a gentle yoga class, if for those unfamiliar, is just a class where you don't really exert yourself. You don't hold poses that are strenuous, because that's not the purpose of gentle yoga. And so I finished the class. And I was like, I guess it's all right. I mean, it might be a cool compliment to weightlifting. 2 days later, different class, different style instructor. And I'm just drenched in sweat. We're just moving. But I am like, we're trying to bind our hands behind our body in this weird pose. And I'm just watching the sweat pour onto the mat. And the instructor comes by, you know, this lovely woman, and she just bends down and whispers, use your hand towel. And so I had a hand towel. So I grab the hand towel and I wipe my face from all the sweat. And she says, no, use it to bind your hands. I'm like, oh yeah. Okay. Oh, I can totally bind my hands now. But I left the class, like in the end of most yoga classes, you have what's called Shavasana or corpse pose, and you just lie still. And it's kind of this both deeply intense focus, but also relaxation. And you realize they're kind of one and the same when you really come down to it. And it's beautiful. And I left class. I'm like, what was that? Like, that felt weird. And then I think I took a couple more classes. And what I realized was, you know, in my last assignment in the Marine Corps, I spent a lot of time like in Honduras and in Panama, working with their militaries or their defense industries. And I might get like 50 email a week. And then working for an IT company, which produces email, I would get like 50 email in 2 hours. And so I would leave work and my mind would just be all this noise and be to-do lists and reminders and PowerPoints and Word documents and Outlook. And I found when I stepped into the yoga room and sat down on the yoga mat, it just got quiet. And I was like, okay, what is that? That I want more of that. I'm gonna do that. And I got hooked. And a year later, I became an instructor. And I say instructor because I was raised with a Judeo-Christian background. And so being exposed to Krishna and Vishnu and Shiva and, you know, the Hindu association with yoga, I like, all right, I'm not going to get too close to that. Like, I want to keep my distance from that. But enough of it came around me that I started to understand the practice and the principles of it. And yeah, I became hooked. And then it was, okay, how can I make yoga part of me? And then how can I give that to other people?
Yeah, I had a really similar experience. I mean, I remember when I was in California, like we were just talking about before we started recording, that was, you know, the first time I went to sort of some proper yoga classes. And I, like you, was doing kind of, you know, vinyasa and just came out absolutely drenched in sweat, like probably some of the hardest work I've done in terms of like fitness. And I'm like a big like gym guy and like runner and stuff. And it was crazy, but you know, so good. And exactly as you say, both for body and for mind. And, you know, with all these experiences kind of bringing it together, you then subsequently went on to, you know, write this down and put it in a book and yep. You know, help other people. It's obviously a really sort of interesting time in the world at the moment in terms of the remote nature of work and, you know, people being sort of stressed at home and having multiple Zoom meetings and things like that. How do you sort of, you know, engage people in workforces to really help them with their, you know, decision-making, relaxation and things like that?
Yeah, well, I think it starts with really being present. And I think for me, in a coaching environment, you know, if you've heard of coaching, what coaching is you just become a reflection for the person you're coaching. And so even in a broad audience, you can share those ideas and practices. And it really comes down to, we all have patterns in our life. We all have beliefs in our life. And those beliefs and patterns shape who we are. And when you come across, like you see something you want to be or something you want to achieve or something you want to aspire to, and you can't get to it, what you realize is it's your patterns that are holding you back. And they may be so ingrained in you that you don't recognize it. But once you recognize it, you can immediately change it. And when you change it, it's like, oh my gosh, it's this big release. And so it's, again, I think we've talked about like mindfulness and meditation and those kind of things coming into our education system. I think they're certainly also permeating society from a corporate and business perspective too, because ultimately now, especially like I just saw an article that said the great resignation is coming. And it's the idea that people don't want to go back to the office. Like there are people who like that was their communion with people, was the guys I work with next to me, the women I work with, those are my friends. And if I, for some reason, haven't been able to maintain those relationships during the pandemic by getting together, I really want to do it by getting back to the office. But there are just as many people who are like, I like working from home. I like that I can be super focused and super productive and get 40 hours of work done in 30 hours or 25 hours. And then if I'm going to go take a swim or go for a jog at lunchtime, because I can, everything I need is here. I need to pack a bag and take it to the locker room and go change in the locker room. And so it's, you see now it's an interesting shift, because for companies to hire people, they can't just say, well, we've got great benefits. We've got childcare on site. We've got dentists, we've got doctors, we've got massage, whatever. Now it's gonna be like, well, what's your work from home policy like? Because I do great work when I'm sitting at home and I can just, between calls, I can go to my kitchen and get something to eat. I'm going to go to the break room. Any relationships that I have from work that I really want to maintain, I did. I've still maintained those. There's still some people that I'd love to see, but work isn't something that we go to. It's something we do. And so it doesn't have to be about going to the office. And I think that's the shift that we're coming to. Companies are going to have to rethink what's our employee experience, because that's what's going to bring people to us. It's not necessarily about the perks. It's about how free do we allow people to be themselves while working for us?
Yes, it's really interesting. I read a blog post recently on sort of some of our company's journey into sort of remote work, and way back in kind of 2019, before work from home and the pandemic came into effect, I was traveling all over the United States. A lot of our tech team were based in Europe still, and so we kind of by necessity really were kind of remote from day one, and we sort of continued that when we hired people in both the US and internationally. And so, for us, it's been really, really interesting because as a, company of only sort of 3 years old, we've had that in our DNA since day one, that we're going to allow people to kind of work from anywhere, take breaks, integrating things like mindfulness into the company culture. But, yeah. But for a lot of big organizations, they're now stuck because as we're sort of coming to the, what is hopefully the tail end of, the kind of pandemic that we've been through as a kind of society, do you make people come back into the offices? Do you have to change everything up from an HR point of view? What have you, seen with some of the people that you work with in that respect?
Well, so we're in the process of looking to, I've seen companies in the area here are in the process of opening up on a gradual basis. And so I think at the end of July, if you absolutely need to be in the facility, you can come into the facility. And then by September, I think it's going to be more liberal, but it's not, you're coming into the office, like we're going to make you, but that's not true. Like that's in IT. And I think some of the more tech savvy industries, I saw something that said Bank of America is telling people you're coming back into the office. I think what's going to happen is what people are going to find is when you force someone to do something, like no one wants to do that. Like unless there's some real benefit or service, or I'm going to grow from it. But by definition, if that's how much you're defining someone's life and work is something you go to and have to do, then when people hear about, oh my gosh, well here you can work from home or you can have tattoos on your arms or they have Pride Month celebrations or whatever, those things are going to be the differentiating factor because ultimately it's going to come down to, oh, I can be more of me at this company than I can at your company. I don't care about the, I pay and stuff's important, but who I am is more important and they want to cultivate and recognize that, whereas this company doesn't. So I think companies like Bank of America or other companies who have more of a traditionalist view are going to find themselves at a competitive disadvantage when they start to realize, oh my gosh, it's not just about forcing people to do what we need them to do. It's about getting them to enjoy what they do while they do it.
100%. I mean, it's going to be really, really fascinating to look at how different organizations, different sizes of organizations really tackle this. Just as we sort of start to wrap things up, in terms of, your own personal situation and the amazing journey that you've been on, what are some of your kind of, reflections on where you are at the moment in terms of, the decisions you've kind of made and your own kind of like work-life balance, for kind of anyone listening to see how they could potentially get to where you're at?
No, I think the biggest takeaway when you asked that question, the first thing that came to mind to me was I went to a Tony Robbins event 4 years ago in 2017. And I followed his tapes and stuff. And like he was in a movie or something. I'm like, okay, there's something to this because this guy is obviously full of energy. And it was something that it was outside of what I normally do because the ticket, I think, was like $3,000. I would never spend that kind of money on going to see someone talk about how to improve myself. Like, it was just like, I'm not going to do that. But I did. And one of the most insightful and powerful things that he said was life doesn't happen to you. Life happens for you. And so when he said that, I remember just this feeling of something just kind of washed over me because in one sense, it's so simple to make that observation, but I'm also looking at where it's coming from. And this is a guy that has had tremendous success. And yet even in his late 50s, loves spending 18 hours a day helping people become more fulfilled in their lives. And I remember I walked away from that event and I kind of that stayed with me. And when you start to look at it that way, if you think life happens to you, then you're perpetually a victim because all this stuff is happening to me. I have to react to it. And that creates a pattern of victimhood. If you think that life happens for you, forget about the universe or God or some higher purpose, but then there's a lesson to be had in everything. And when you can sort of make the shift to be, okay, what can I learn from this? How can I grow from this? Then every day is a pleasure because it's like, okay, I'm going to grow in some way today that I'm not even sure how yet. Even if I have a plan or purpose of what I want to accomplish, what I'm going to, you know, things I want to achieve or goals, the idea that life happens for me means there's a little bit of it that's unknown. And if I can be receptive to that, then I'm going to improve as a person. And I think that's the biggest approach. That's the biggest shift I've made in my life. And I remember I had this conversation with my daughter, I think 2 years ago. She was going through a breakup. And I realized what I realized coming out of this life happens to you, not, or life happens for you, not to you. One of the other things that he said at some point was, like, when something ends, there's always something better behind it. And again, I felt like I've heard that for years, but it didn't sink in until I like heard it from him. And because I was ready to place in my life to where I could receive that kind of message. And so I told my daughter, I'm like, well, you know, whatever is going to come next after this relationship is just going to be better. And she's like, yeah, Dad, I know. I'm like, oh, well, it took me like 40 something years to figure that out. So fine. But I think that's it. Like it all comes down to how you view life. And if you choose to view life as happening for you, then there's beauty in every moment and every day. And you just have to like receive it or experience it and be like, oh my God, I transform, like I've grown a little bit today. And that's the most rewarding thing.
Yeah, no, I think it's, you know, one of the things you've done that I'm a huge fan of is obviously, you know, putting down a lot of your experiences into kind of book form as well and sort of sharing that with people. How did that kind of come about and what sort of, you know, some of the take home messages that people might be really interested in picking up?
No, I always wanted to write. I loved growing up. One of my stability things, besides, I think I had a security blanket when I was a kid, but one of my other securities was comic books. I love the fantastic stories in comic books. And it was so captivating to me. And so when I got into high school, I wasn't good at math, really didn't understand science. Biology, I kind of got because it was like, I don't know, for some reason, biology more earthy, I guess. But English was strong. And so I got national recognition in the US for a short story I wrote. I had poetry that won contests. I was like, oh, that's so cool. But again, I didn't take myself seriously as a writer. I wanted to be the next Stephen King. And I thought like Stephen King is this, I mean, Pet Sematary is crazy. Like the scariest book I've ever read. And I was like, I can't do that. There's no way. So I joined the Marines. I got out of the Marines in 2006. And I had started to write some poetry. I had a boss in the Marines who painted, like he had paintings on his walls in his office. And that for me was mind blowing because I didn't see that kind of artisticness in the military. Like it was just almost non-existent. You just didn't see that. And so that got me, I found a muse. I started writing some poetry. And then when I got out of the Marines, like the writing bug came back. I'm like, okay, I'm going to go for Stephen King. Like I want to write a horror story. And so on three different occasions over probably a period of about 5 or 6 years, I had an idea for a horror story and I started writing it. I get about 100 pages in, I was all motivated. And then the story would peter out and I'd lose interest and I'd set it aside and I'd be dejected for a couple months. And then something would happen. And I have a new idea. So I did that. And then in 2016, I started reading Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich. And in the first or second chapter of that book, he says, what is your purpose in life? I'm like, purpose in life? My life has a purpose? What? That doesn't make sense. Are you serious? Wait, my life has a purpose. And so I got really excited and it was a surge of inspiration. And I'm like, I'm going to write a book about finding your purpose in life. And I wrote a purpose statement down and then I started writing and I wrote like 200 pages. It was all autobiographical and because I was like, oh, this is going to be a majestic story and there's going to be movies made and everything else. And that took me about 4 months to write. So like in April of 2017, I looked at where I was. I was like, no one is going to care about this story. Like this is terrible. Like I can't subject people to this. I'm only halfway done. So this is going to be a 500 page opus for people to write, you know, about this guy who found his life's purpose. So I threw all that away. I wrote a 10 chapter outline for a self-help book. And then in 2 months, I wrote Whiskey and Yoga. It came out in October of that year, number one on Amazon in self-help and yoga. And it was hugely rewarding, But like, I remember the moment it went to number one because I had a 42-year-old bottle of scotch that I was going to take a drink of, and I did. And but then like the next week, one of the people who had helped me launch the book successfully, he was like, well, what's behind it? What else you got behind your book? And I didn't really have anything. I'm like, well, I guess, can I help people find their purpose? Like, can I put a workshop together? So I started wrestling with that. And then I had the idea for The Lighthouse Keeper, my second book, while I was writing Whiskey and Yoga. But I kind of let it go. I kind of had to let it gestate. And then 18 months later, I think I saw a video about a Hindu monk who kind of described the relationship between your mind and your awareness in a similar sense to The Lighthouse Keeper. And I was like, oh my God, that's The Lighthouse Keeper. So I wrote The Lighthouse Keeper. It came out last year. And then it's just, the journey of a writer is, for me, has been so enriching, because part of it is like, especially I started working on my third book right when the pandemic began. And it was mind blowing, because it was, the idea of the book was, it's who we are is more important than what we do. But what we do is always shaping who we are. And I started writing conventionally, you know, on a computer, and I wrote the first chapter and I felt pretty comfortable about it because I had laid out my case pretty nicely. And then I said, you know what? I'm not going to do this. I don't want to write this like this. So I grabbed a notebook, I grabbed two separate pens, and I started having like a text conversation almost with these two pens. And so I was like, now I've got 8 journals full of stuff. I'm not sure exactly what of that's going to constitute the third book, but writing for me has been the thing that I've always wanted to connect to the writer inside me. And so doing that now at this stage of my life, like I used to think, oh my God, this is so bad that it's taken me so long. But in a lot of ways, I'm doing it right when I need to do it. So that's the beauty of it.
That's absolutely amazing. And as we kind of close things out here, obviously at the end of this podcast, we always ask everyone about their human performance hero. So I'd be really interested to hear who yours is.
Yeah. So I would go with, I would go back to Tony Robbins, just because for me, I mean, I look at him, and without going into too much detail about his story, but, you know, had 4 fathers by the time he was like 15 or 16, someone gave his family food one Thanksgiving, and that changed his life. So the next year he went out to feed people, and now he's fed, I think, you know, close to 1 billion people worldwide in the time that he's done that. But you also see like what he's done to himself. Like he, his vocal cords, your vocal cords should be the size of like, I think, your like your pinky or something. And his are the size of a piece of paper, because he talks for a living. Like that's all he's done. And so he said at some point, like when he would see the doctors, like, you shouldn't be able to talk, but somehow what you've done is you've created a false voice box from your diaphragm, and that's how you're able to speak. And so even now at 61, I just did something with him a few weeks back, and the energy he brings, and you know, it's not because he knows the secret to really life is to contribute and to give. And when you do that from a genuine place, authentically, what you receive is so incredible. And so like, you can see that this is a guy who does things out of love. And I have tremendous respect and admiration for Tony.
Amazing. Awesome. Awesome example. David, it's been fantastic speaking to you. And I'm hoping that as the world opens back up, I can come out and catch up with you in person at some point in North Carolina, if all being well. But in the interim, if anyone does want to sort of get in touch with you, how can they find you?
Alex, it's been so great talking to you. I would love for you to come out to North Carolina. We'll go to the beach. We'll go to the mountains here. There's such incredible scenery here in North Carolina. So I am online at davidrichardsauthor.com, Instagram, davidrichardsauthor, and then Twitter, davidrichardsa2.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's an absolute pleasure, and keep doing all you're doing. And thanks again so much for your service.
Alex, thank you so much.